You're listening to BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon, it's the Bigger Picture and it's Mira Sevisodi. Helen Fisher, and an anthropologist who is also known as the Queen Mum of romance research, once said that love can be stronger than the drive to stay alive. But is love just a matter of the heart and mind? We explore how science plays a part in relationships with Dr. Ian Stephen. He's a professor and expert in human sciences. How are you today, Dr. Ian?
Yeah, doing okay, thank you.
Okay, the science of relationships, I mean, what do you really mean?
Well, people quite often think that there are whole areas of sort of human relationships that science can't say an awful lot about. And that's generally because they think that science is all about molecules and stars and things like that. And science is about that, but science can also be about relationships and the way that people interact with each other. Mm-hmm. And the reason this is because science is just a way of looking at the world. It's a way of looking at the evidence and the data, coming up with new hypotheses or new predictions about the way that the world should work, mm-hmm. and then going out and testing those.
Okay.
And that way of understanding things can be applied to a whole range of things. So,
could you give me an example?
So if we're talking about the science of relationships, what this really is, it's normally investigated by psychologists like myself. And the way that I kind of look at these science of relationships is using something called evolutionary psychology. And this is kind of a mixture of evolutionary biology, psychology, and economics. And it's looking at the way that kind of people relate to each other, what kind of benefits that people get out of relationships with different kinds of people and from different sorts of relationships.
That's very interesting. What have your findings been?
My research in particular is about face perception and about what makes people find other people attractive. Mm-hmm. And these kind of trade-offs, the kind of that we think of economics in terms of money and services being exchanged, but you can also apply these same kind of scientific models and scientific techniques to other things being exchanged. So in the relationship, you might be talking about support being exchanged, or friendship, or favors, or in the romantic relationships, perhaps more personal things being exchanged as well. And what we're looking at in terms of attractiveness research and in terms of kind of relationship research is how these things are being exchanged and what people are looking for when they're looking for someone to get into this kind of relationship with.
Okay, so what are they looking out for? I mean, let's start with, you know, the eyes, since you sort of, you know, specialize in the face. I was reading that 90% of the world's population has brown eyes. Mm-hmm. But something as mysterious as a person's eyes is so intricately linked with the soul. Now, why is that? I mean, and people, the minority, 10% are probably blue-eyed and the works, but blue eyes seem to give out a different sort of, you know, vibe. Why is that?
Mm-hmm. Well, blue eyes are limited pretty much exclusively to European populations. Mm-hmm. There are some Indian people that have green eyes as well, but yeah, as you said, most people have
dark brown
eyes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's actually thought that all people with blue eyes have the same gene for blue eyes. There's just one gene for blue eyes, which suggests that they have that they actually all share an ancestor, one single ancestor. But in terms of why it's kind of linked with their soul, humans are really the only ones that seem to get a good amount of information from the eyes of what we call conspecifics, of other people looking at other people seem to get much more information than, say, chimpanzees looking at other chimpanzees. And part of this is because of how social we are. Part of it is because of how intelligent we are. And part of this is because we're also the only ones to have kind of a large area of whites in our eyes. And what this means is that you can tell really well where someone is looking. And if you can tell where someone is looking, you can make, particularly if you've got a good big brain as well, you can make a pretty good inference as to what they're thinking and what they're about to do. Mm-hmm. So it's likely that this kind of link with what we think of as the soul started off as this. So you can tell so much about someone by where they're looking and by the facial expression that comes with it, right. A lot of which is expressed through the eyes.
Okay.
So this is probably why that link is made.
Okay. Helen Fisher said it is possible to prove if someone is genuinely in love by studying the brain. What would you say about that? I mean, especially just a minute ago, you said something about if you have a bigger brain. I mean, I didn't realize some of us have a bigger brain than the other people. I had no idea.
Well, so some people have bigger brains than other people, but probably more importantly than that is people have bigger brains at least compared to our body weight than animals, and that's.
And, I got the context wrong.
Yeah. So, I mean, there are some animals that are intelligent, like dolphins, but okay. They're probably still not as intelligent as people.
Okay.
But yeah, what were
so
we talking
is it,
about?
So is it possible to prove if someone is genuinely in love by studying their brain?
It could be. As far as I know, no one has proved that. But part of this kind of development of what we call love, so the kind of the change from infatuation into love is to do with a hormone called oxytocin, and this is released into our brains when we engage in certain behaviors, kind of kissing, cuddling, and kind of more intimate things than that as well.
Mm-hmm.
And this causes this hormone called oxytocin to be released. And this is really closely associated with bonding, particularly between kind of romantic partners. And this has its impact on the brain. So it really can be quite true to say that this is rewiring the brain in a certain way, and that if you are looking at the face of a loved one, say, compared to looking at the face of a stranger, your brain responds in a different way. And now with these kind of brain imaging techniques that we have these days, it can be possible to put someone in, say, an fMRI scanner, instantly developed at the University of Nottingham, where I work.
Mm-hmm.
But could be possible to put people in this fMRI scanner and see the bits of their brain lighting up in a different pattern,
right,
when they're looking at someone that they love compared to someone that they really don't know.
Okay, and that's just love, right? Oxytocin is released. What happens when lust is involved? What is really released? Is it oxytocin as well?
Oxytocin doesn't really seem to be associated with lust. I mean, what we call the sex hormones seem to be more associated with kind of lust and sex drive and things. So that's testosterone in men in particular.
Mm-hmm.
And estrogen, but also to an extent testosterone affects it in women as well.
Mm-hmm.
And this tends to determine kind of your sex drive, kind of in more immediate terms. It's actually more of a response in your nervous system rather than in your hormones, but hormones do respond to kind of lustful interactions. Okay. as well.
Nervous system, that's interesting. How? Mm. Could you explain to me just very quickly?
Well, essentially the kind of the brain and the nervous system are kind of an information processing system, and they take these inputs like you would think of in a computer and produce certain kind of behavioral and behavioral responses, and kind of things that you perhaps find arousing, be that kind of by looking at an attractive person or by touching, things like that. These inputs are then interpreted by the brain and produce the kind of responses both in the mind and in the body that you associate with that kind of interaction.
Okay, so nothing to do with hormones in the brain?
There are hormones involved as well.
Serotonin
and that kind of thing are associated with reward. So perhaps come kind of nearer to the end of the process. But that's involved as well.
Interesting. fMRIs, have you studied the male brain when it comes to these things such as sex and lust?
These things have been studied. I personally haven't, though.
Okay. So, no testosterone found in the fMRI in a male brain.
There certainly is testosterone in male brains.
Kidding me?
The testosterone
in the male brain.
Yeah, okay. Testosterone's everywhere, and it drives all kinds of things. what it means to be males, right from kind of development of a male fetus in the womb, that the fetus only becomes male because of testosterone acting on the fetus. If testosterone was either not being produced or was not being received properly by the fetus, it would develop physically female,
right,
even though it would be genetically male.
Sure.
And this testosterone effect carries on all the way through life, and it's thought to be, it's the reason why men are bigger and kind of have more muscle mass than women. It's the reason why men are more aggressive than women, and all sorts of things.
Okay. Are we meant to be monogamous?
That kind of depends what you mean by meant to be. So if you look at kind of pure numbers, if you look at the numbers of, because obviously some societies are monogamous and others are not in terms of marriage. So most societies, the biggest number of societies, are not monogamous. Then the biggest number of societies are what we call polygamous. So men are allowed to have more than one wife, but women are not allowed to have more than one husband. And that obviously includes kind of many Islamic societies as well. But the biggest number of people live in monogamous societies. And even in polygamous societies, the biggest number of people are, at least marriage-wise, are monogamous. So most people, even in a polygamous society, will only have one wife.
But scientifically, what's going on?
Scientifically, if you look at... So one way to see if people really are monogamous is to look at whether children's fathers are who they think they are, because one symptom of the kind of the break from this
that has nothing to do with science
monogamy. It does. You have to do a scientific survey to see if to see what it is, and you have to do DNA testing to see if people are people's fathers are who they think they are. You can see this in generally you get a figure of between kind of 5% and 15% whose fathers are not who they think they are. And this kind of study has also been done in birds as well, and birds are live in a, what we call social monogamy. They pair up, and a lot of species of birds pair up for life in much the same way that people do. But if you look at the DNA of the chicks in the nests, there's again, depending on species, kind of 5%, 10%, 20% of these chicks have fathers that are different to the father that is the female's life-bonded partner.
Right.
So one way of looking at this is that people are kind of socially monogamous on the whole, but when it comes to kind of strict monogamy and whether they actually behave in a monogamous fashion, then some people still are, and a lot of people, unfortunately, are not.
Okay, that's interesting. Coming up, we'll continue this discussion. If you have a question for Dr. Ian Stephen, do text 016-201-9000 or tweet BFM Radio.
You're listening to BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
Good afternoon. It's The Bigger Picture and it's Mira Sivasodhi. Welcome if you have just joined us. With me is Dr. Ian Stephen. He's a professor and expert in human sciences and we're discussing the science in relationships. Now, Dr. Ian, just going back to that whole brown eyes, blue-eyed people and how attractive the blue-eyed people are. Why is it in our supposedly post-racial age this whole Aryan look is still so desirable?
Well, there are a couple of different theories about why this might be. One is just that the social environment is such that there are a lot of kind of Westerners on TV. There's a lot of Westerners in the movies, and most of the Westerners in that you encounter in KL are probably kind of relatively wealthy compared to some of the locals. So one explanation is that it's this kind of social mechanism. So people see Westerners as being desirable because they're in this kind of more socially dominant position.
Mm-hmm. Also, could it be because they're so small in numbers? I mean, you're unique, you're different in this country.
That's true. I mean, it's being small in numbers can be good and it can be bad. And there has been some research done on this topic of whether people find their own ethnic group more attractive or whether they find other ethnic groups more attractive or perhaps somewhere in between. Mm-hmm. And the biggest study of this kind was done with Australian white Australians and Japanese people, and they got a whole load of photographs of white Australians and a whole load of photographs of Japanese, and kind of they also made intermediate steps, so people they merged these faces together to make them look like they were part Japanese and part Western, and they also got people photographs of people who are part Western and part Asian. Mm-hmm. And then they asked Westerners and Japanese people to rate how attractive they found them. And what they found was that the faces that people found most attractive were actually somewhere in between. It was kind of this mixed race look that people found the most attractive. Mm-hmm. And you can kind of see that reflected around KL as well. If you look at an awful lot of the advertising billboards, for example, there are a lot of kind of ethnically ambiguous looking people who they might be Chinese, they might be Malay, they might be Indian, or they might be Caucasian or somewhere in between. Mm-hmm. And this is probably partly because more people can identify with them, but also partly because this is what people consider to be attractive. And the reason why kind of being mixed race might look more attractive is that, you know, that if you there's this taboo about obviously having children with, say, your sister, and that is because all of our DNA has mistakes in it. All of it has mutations in it. And a lot of these mutations do no harm at all as long as you only have one copy of it. We all have two copies of our DNA. And as long as we get half of it from our mother and half of it from our father, one copy from mother, one from father. And as long as you only have one copy of these mutations, they don't really do you any harm. But if you get two copies, then it can be really quite bad for you. So if you have children with, say, if your parents are brother and sister with each other, your chances of getting two copies of one of these mutations are much, much higher. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you have children with someone who's not only not your sister, but not your same ethnic group, your chances of your children having two copies of any of these mutations are really very small. So what you find is that fewer kind of mild genetic diseases are being expressed, fewer mutations are actually being expressed. So you end up with an individual that has fewer what we might kind of refer to as perhaps genetic defects being expressed. Mm-hmm. So that's expected to look good. Another thing is that someone who's kind of mixed race is different, but not really different. So perhaps someone that you can identify with, but again, someone that's not too close to yourself.
Right, okay. But so are you saying then that marrying someone of a different race is safer?
In terms of kind of the number of DNA mutations that you're mm-hmm. going to get expressed. Yeah, it is, yeah.
Okay, interesting. That's very interesting. No one has actually, we always refer to it as incest and stuff like that, but nobody has scientifically actually explained why.
Why incest is not a good idea.
That's right. Yeah. And as well as, you know, marrying in the family mm-hmm. is not the best idea.
Yeah.
Women tend to find certain characteristics more appealing during different phases of their fertility cycles. Now, why is that?
Well, this kind of goes back to when we were talking about monogamy. Mm-hmm. And what this particularly refers to sort of how manly the women like their men to be. And very masculine men, kind of big, strong, very manly looking, may kind of perhaps look more attractive, but there is some evidence that because of their kind of high levels of testosterone, that they might not necessarily be the best husband or the best father, because testosterone increases your chances of being aggressive. Mm-hmm. It also increases sex drive and the kind of desire to perhaps look for women to have relationships with who are not your wife. And what you see, therefore, is that women have a choice. Do they want a masculine man who perhaps has these good genes to pass on to their children, but might not be perhaps the best partner? Mm-hmm. Or do they want a more feminine man who perhaps has less good genes, but is more likely to be more caring and less likely to cheat or to run off?
Okay. Feminine is a rather strong word, don't you think?
Oh, it's all kind of relative. I don't mean necessarily men that look like women, but men who perhaps are not the
as
stereotypical
aggressive,
big strong man. So yeah. maybe if you think about, I don't know, the difference between Arnold Schwarzenegger and Leonardo DiCaprio. Mm-hmm. Now,
right.
Leonardo DiCaprio doesn't necessarily look like a woman, and a lot of women are very attracted to Leonardo DiCaprio, but he's not as manly as Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Right.
Okay, so this is the kind of thing. Yeah.
Sure.
So the women have this kind of choice. Do they want the good genes or do they want the good partner? But there is a way to get both. Well, there are a couple of ways to get both.
Really?
One is to find
Why didn't I meet you before?
Well, wait until you hear what the way to get both is first. One way to get both is to be a really, really attractive woman, and then you perhaps don't have to worry so much. You can get a manly man and not have to worry so much about him running off.
Right.
The other way is perhaps you can have one man who is the genetic father of your children and another man who is the kind of practical father of your children. Mm-hmm. And this is where the kind of the menstrual cycle comes in. You see that women are only fertile during a window of kind of 5 days or something during the menstrual cycle. And during that time, their attraction to very manly men increases, particularly very manly men who are not their husband or long-time boyfriend.
Right.
And during the period of their cycle where they're not fertile, their attraction to less manly men, so to more feminine men, increases. And what it's thought is that on a unconscious level, women are adjusting who they're attracted to kind of get this benefits of the good genes from the masculine men and the good partner and parent from the feminine men.
Mm-hmm. Very, very interesting. It's about time all of us actually
so this isn't practical
more
advice,
attention.
By the way. This is
you know, we don't really think about this, but it's interesting. Is there enough evidence of studies and research to back this up?
Mm-hmm. Yep, there's quite a few where you can take pictures of manly men's faces and less manly men's faces and ask women to rate them at different stages of their menstrual cycle, and you see this changing. Similar thing happens with bodies. Women prefer more manly bodies during the fertile phase of the menstrual cycle, so bodies that are kind of with more muscle mass compared to the less fertile phase. And even in a kind of a series of really strange experiments, find the smell of manly men more attractive during the fertile phase.
Right.
And I'm saying this is strange because what they did was they asked men to wear t-shirts for 24 hours and then asked women to smell these t-shirts and say whether they found them whether they liked the smell or not.
Mm-hmm.
And amazingly, they preferred the smell of the manly men during their fertile phase and the less manly men during the non-fertile phase.
Jeremy wants to know, I mean, he's texted in and he says, Tiger Woods' wife was very attractive, yet he cheated.
Yeah, that is true. Tiger Woods also had the opportunity to cheat with an awful lot of women. And not only was Tiger Woods kind of, well, people may have views on whether he's attractive or not, but there was one rather important thing about Tiger Woods which probably helped him to get that very attractive wife, which is that he has a huge amount of money.
Mm-hmm.
So whereas his wife was very attractive, given the amount of opportunity to cheat that Tiger Woods had, was she attractive enough to stop him wanting to take any of those opportunities? And also, was Tiger Woods' personality just such that he perhaps had more of a propensity to cheat on her anyway? And obviously, the way it turned out, he chose to take those opportunities.
Mm-hmm. But and as you said, every man has that those opportunities. So it's a question of whether they want to take it or not.
Mm-hmm. And different men have different, perhaps, numbers of opportunities, and the people that they have the opportunity to cheat with maybe have different attractiveness to other men. So, I mean, Tiger Woods was... I didn't follow the story too closely, but I'm guessing he probably cheated with models and things like that. Now, probably not all men have the opportunity to cheat with a succession of supermodels and actresses.
Right. So the temptation was there.
Mm, yeah.
Do opposites attract?
Opposites sometimes attract and sometimes similarity attracts. There's quite an interesting experiment where they took photos of people and they asked them to complete a personality test, and then they asked another group of people what kind of personality traits they look for in a partner, and then asked them to rate how attractive these faces were.
Mm-hmm.
Just the faces, they weren't told what the personality of the people were. And people who said that they wanted an outgoing partner rated the faces of people whose personality tests showed them to be outgoing more highly. So in that case, this is kind of personality, similar personalities attracting. And there were a few other kind of most personality traits. People seem to prefer partners with a similar personality. Where this changed, though, was that men who were very dominant found women who were quiet and submissive.
Mm-hmm.
And this kind of worked vice versa as well. So women who were scored very high on a personality trait of ruthlessness liked men who are very quiet and submissive.
Right.
So it seems like people were looking like looking for partners who are like themselves, but when it comes to kind of dominance or submissiveness, people who have this kind of tendency to be very dominant are looking for people that they can perhaps dominate in the relationship. They don't want they don't want someone who can give as much, as good as they get.
Do you think that's most of the time the case, or is it just an observation?
I mean, all of these things are kind of on a statistical level. So kind of like with your texter who came up with an example of something that kind of bucks the trend. For all of these things, there are people, not every single person follows the trend in the same way. And I mean, you can see this in all kinds of things when it comes to do with people. So you can say that men are taller than women, but anyone I'm sure can think of either some men who are very short or some women who are very tall who buck this trend. But you can't deny that overall men are taller than women.
Right.
And it's a similar in this way. Statistically, these things are more likely to be true for men than women, or that statistically what I'm saying is accurate, but it's not necessarily the case for every single person out
there. Jeremy has written back to say, I think people's faith or belief will help them stay faithful.
I'm sure that's true, yeah. I mean, whether people choose to cheat or not has all kinds of things. I mean, social aspects, including and in humans, faith is part of this kind of social milieu. I think if people are wanting to stay faithful, I'm sure in most cases they can. Mm-hmm. Again, this is kind of statistical level, that people who are more masculine are more likely to cheat, but that doesn't mean that every masculine man is going to cheat, nor does it mean that every less masculine man is not going to cheat. Mm-hmm. And similarly, whereas more attractive women's partners are less likely to cheat on them, that doesn't mean that very attractive women's partners will never cheat on them, nor does it mean that less attractive women's partners will always cheat on them.
Right. How important is it to have a spouse who is genetically similar? I mean, when we are attracted to somebody, apparently it could be because subconsciously we like their genes. I mean, could you elaborate? How do we even know that?
So there are a couple of ways that that people have looked at this. Generally, people actually are attracted to people who are genetically dissimilar, not genetically similar. So people who are genetically different to themselves. There was an experiment in which they took some faces, took photos of people, and then they got all the opposite sex faces. So for me, for example, they would have taken all the female faces and used computer graphics to make them all look slightly more like me and slightly less like me. Okay, and they did that for all the participants. And then they showed people these faces in pairs, and they said which one is more attractive. And they also did another test, which was which one is more trustworthy. And what they found was that actually faces that look more like us, so that we kind of see them as being more closely related to us, look more trustworthy to us. But they actually look less attractive to us.
Right.
We are more attracted to people that look less like us than
more like us.
Yeah.
That's very interesting. So that's what you mean by genetically similar.
Mm.
Is it just looks?
Not necessarily. I mean, another way that this kind of thing has been done is that you can do genetic tests on people, and you can see how many genes people share in common with other people, and again measure how attractive those people find each other. And again, typically you find people will find others who are less genetically similar to themselves more attractive. And you can see this in, again, these kind of weird smelling experiments.
Right. Aren't we like 99.9% genetically the same, all of us?
Yes. Yes, we are. But when we're talking about these kind of... So all of us are kind of 99%, more than that, genetically similar to each other. Mm-hmm. We're 99% genetically similar to chimpanzees. We're kind of about 20% genetically similar to plants.
Right.
But what's really important in this case is those genes where people are not similar to each other. So we've got all these 99% that are the same, but that 1% that is different is what makes all the genetic difference in all the population. So it's what makes Chinese people look different to Westerners. It's what make women look different to men. It's what make all of this all of these differences.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really those that are variable, those genes that are variable between people, that are important. So we use kind of, we say things like we share 50% of our genes with our brother or sister. What that means is that of these genes that are different between mm-hmm. different people,
which is point
we
something
share 50%
percent.
Of
right.
them.
Which is yeah. point something percent.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
You know, with all this knowledge available to us, Dr. Ian, why is it that people still end up with incompatible mates? What goes wrong?
I mean, this can happen for all sorts of different reasons. One reason is that perhaps you might find someone very attractive, but your personalities don't match. Another possible reason is people's personalities and people's experiences change over time. So you could be very compatible when you first get together, but then kind of grow apart. Another issue is that if you perhaps think of your ideal man or your ideal woman, you're probably thinking of someone who's really, really attractive. Now, if that person existed in real life and you were to make advances towards them, for some people that might be successful. But bearing in mind that people really share an awful lot of this idea of what makes people attractive, and people will to a huge extent agree on out of two people who's more attractive than the other, for this kind of ideal partner, the competition is pretty huge. Now, unless you're also extremely attractive and extremely funny and wealthy and all the rest of it, chances are you might be wasting your time. You might be better off kind of approaching someone who's a bit kind of more your level.
So you're just saying forget the fairy tales. Is that what you're saying?
I'm not saying that. I'm saying don't devote all your energies to trying to date Brad Pitt or Angelina Jolie, because chances are, well, they might call the police if you try too hard, but also you're likely to be wasting a fair bit of time. And people's kind of ratings as other people as attractiveness do also change in relation to how attractive we see ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
So people who see themselves very attractive tend to be more discriminating and tend to rate perhaps less attractive people, even less attractive than most other people would say them. Whereas people who are perhaps less attractive themselves will find people... We'll kind of rate people of around the same level as more attractive than other people mm-hmm. would do. So again, subconsciously, people are recalibrating their sights according to their own attractiveness, and therefore according to their kind of how realistic it is that they're likely to their advances are likely to be met.
Right. And as a Hindu, I'm going to ask you: does karma play a role in all of this? Thank you. Okay, so. Thank you. He's speechless. He doesn't know what to say. Thank you for joining us today. Dr. Ian Stephen, Professor and Expert in Human Sciences on the Science in Relationships on The Big Picture, BFM 89.9.
BFM 89.9, The Business Station.